RAC's Post-Op Podcast is brought to you with the compliments of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons and leading financial services organisation, the Bongiorno National Network, the preferred choice for medical professionals across Australia. At the age of 68, General Surgeon Ivan Thompson was preparing to finish up his clinical practice in Perth, WA, but wasn't quite prepared to do nothing at all. He'd always wanted to do humanitarian work overseas, and an opportunity to volunteer with Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, seemed an attractive challenge to take on. Ivan's first posting was in the northern region of Iraq, near the Kurdistan border, which had a large number of displaced people, and conditions far removed from what we're used to back home. As Ivan readily admits, he was taken well out of his comfort zone, but it was an extraordinary experience, one he would recommend to anyone who's looking to push their own boundaries. First, Ivan Thompson takes Chris Ashmore through the process of that first assignment.
Before you go on a posting, they have what they call a welcome course, which is really an induction course to MSF, which you have to do every 2 years if you haven't been on an assignment in the interim period. And it was actually during that period that I actually, that was I think in May, early June, and then I got word that I was going to Iraq. So the place I was going to in Iraq was a place called Kayara, and that was up almost on the Iraqi-Kurdistan border. So there's going to be a bit of potential conflict between the Kurds and the Iraqis, the Arab Iraqis, because they were about to have a Kurdistan referendum, independence referendum. So that was always going on in the background. From a medical point of view, I needed to brush up a few things. This particular assignment didn't require obstetric, cesarean section expertise, although I'd actually did go and do that just in case I got caught. About 50% of the workload at Kayara was burns. Now, I'm a general surgeon, and in my last years of practice, I've been mainly an endocrine surgeon and renal transplant surgeon, so burns, again, needed a bit of brushing up. So I went to a local burns hospital and spent a few weeks just brushing up my knowledge on burns. Things hadn't changed a lot since early days, but yeah, there were nuances that needed to be addressed. Orthopedics, certainly a bit of a hole in my knowledge. Hadn't done that since early days, but again, looking after closed fractures was not a major problem, although it did need a bit of revision. And things like head injuries, I hadn't done any neurosurgery for years, but in practice, if you had a bad head injury in that sort of setting, you were put in a corner and allowed to die because there was no possibility of ventilator beds, no possibility of referring to any centre that could actually manage neurosurgery. So there were certain practicalities. There was a triaging. You had to decide what was salvageable, what was not salvageable, and put your best efforts into what would give the best outcome.
So your role there was very much as a general surgeon, is that right?
Yes. So general surgery and burns, some places burns are part of general surgery, but in Australia burns pretty well have been taken over completely or fall within the plastics field. But to say, I'd done a reasonable amount of burns during my early training, so it wasn't such a major problem to me. And with a little bit of brush up, I think I managed fairly well. We had the criteria of admission. They tried to limit the admissions to the capability of the project, and on theory, we were not supposed to accept any burns more than 20%, which is, it's a significant burn. But in fact, because Kayara was surrounded by internally displaced person camps, Kayara population was probably about 150,000 before the war. It was about over 300,000 at the time I was there. 150,000 of those were displaced persons, mainly from Mosul and northern Iraq. And they all lived in camps, 10 to 12 to a tent, all with open fires, women all wearing long skirts, kids running around with hot water on and oil on open fire stoves. Just a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, some of the other cases that you treated, Ivan, included typhoid fever perforations, something not so well known in Australia. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, typhoid's been around since time immemorial, but I say in places with good public health, that's basically good water supply, you just don't see it. It's very common across Africa, India, and the Middle East. So it's an organism that you, Salmonella typhi, various types. You ingest the organism, you get an initial fever and sort of abdominal pain, gut upset. And then it has this unique thing of that it re-invades after a period of 10 days or so. It re-invades the lymphatic lining of the distal small bowel, and in doing so almost sets up like an autoimmune or a hyperimmune reaction. And during that time, that can actually cause the little collection of lymphocytes in the terminal small bowel, Peyer's patches, and they can actually perforate. And they can be quite difficult to diagnose. They don't always present with frank signs of peritonitis. Patients are often quite malnourished, lethargic, and it's more of diagnosis of suspicion or high alert, so you don't miss them. Often in our society, it'd be relatively easy to diagnose because there's a blood test that can tell you whether you've got typhoid. We've got CT scans, we've got white cell counts, we've got other imaging techniques. In Cairo, I had access to a hemoglobin and a plain abdominal x-ray, which I could only get in office hours, and that's if I was lucky. So it's very much a clinical-based management program.
How many did you treat?
Myself, I had four, and there were another two just before I arrived. And they all did well. We had to either resect or close the hole or bring the bowel out to the surface. We had a combination of all three of those. But sometimes you're dealing with wet blotting paper, and particularly if they present late, it does still have a very high mortality, particularly when you look at places like Africa and the Indian subcontinent.
Were there any challenges with post-operative care? Were you able to look after them afterwards?
The whole of the Iraqi health system really had just imploded. All the nursing care up until the last Gulf War was predominantly provided by Filipino and Southeast Asian nurses. They all left the country. So basically after that, anyone who could put their hand up to be a nurse was called a nurse. So nursing care as we know it just did not exist. Any patient, you know, direct patient care, like washing, feeding, assisting to toilets, showers, etc., that had to be provided by family or caregivers. Nurses did not do that. They had very limited ability to do, you know, basic dressings as we would have in our nursing staff. They mainly just gave drugs if you were lucky. Analgesia was sometimes hard to get them to say that patients should have analgesia. They, you know, changed drips, etc. But nursing care was really quite different to our Western society.
Well, on a personal note, Ivan, having been in such a volatile part of the world, how did you cope with being there for that time?
I mean, as missions go, it was a reasonably stable gig. 2 weeks before I arrived there, there was a pocket of ISIS just south of Cairo, and they got up to within about 10K of the town, in which case the MSF staff had to draw back to Erbil, which is a couple of hours away, for I think it was about a week. And then they managed to push them back. And for the whole time I was there, there weren't any real issues from the point of view of ISIS. We still had problems that if you ventured off the path, there are unexploded IEDs and mortar shells, and that certainly provided a reasonable number of cases with kids coming in with legs blown off and quite nasty injuries. But the main danger was actually what they call happy shooting, where any time the Iraqis had a celebration, be it a wedding, a funeral, a birth, they fire guns into the air, and it's actually when the bullet and what goes up must come down. And in fact, virtually every day or every second day, we had people admitted with gunshot wounds from that cause. If there was a day where there was going to be a number of funerals or a wedding, we were almost confined to barracks, or if we had to go to the hospital, we had to be escorted just to keep those sorts of issues to minimise the risk.
That's incredible. Well, now that you're back, how do you reflect on your mission to Iraq, and would you recommend MSF to others?
Oh, from a personal point of view, I certainly found it satisfying. I felt out of my depth on occasions, although I think my training with the college, I came from an era where early on we did most things, where more recent trainees tend to have a narrower field earlier on, so they may not feel quite so comfortable with some of the things you need to deal with. But I think if you've got good training, you can always apply that, at least the principles. But I say that, as I said earlier, I did feel out of my depth in certain areas, and that's one of the reasons I'd like to go on one of these courses, which would brush up and introduce me to some new techniques, which would make me of more use there. Because you've got very limited ability to refer anywhere else. Here, if you have someone in hospital, in your particular regional hospital, that needs expert care in another institution, you know, it's a telephone call, an ambulance, and they're there. There, it was virtually impossible. As I said, if you had a major head injury, a major chest injury, basically, if you couldn't survive, you died. There was no ability to actively intervene and support them beyond reasonably rudimentary matters.
And it's an experience that you would encourage others to participate in?
I think it's very fulfilling, and I think we live in a very privileged society, and in lots of parts of the world, so they have very limited access to health. And if you can provide that, I think it all makes a difference. You don't go in there and just provide care, a bit like, you know, going in, giving them food but not showing them how to grow crops. You need to go in there. You're supporting what's left of the local health system. Some of it's pretty poor, some of it's a bit better. Standard of Iraqi medicine was pretty good. It was a British-based training scheme. But the idea is to not overtake them and just, you know, get them to stand aside. The idea is to actually go in as partly as a teaching and support role rather than just going in and providing emergency care and then leaving.
Ivan Thompson. RAC's Post-Op Podcast is brought to you with the compliments of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons and leading financial services organisation, the Bongiorno National Network, the preferred choice for medical professionals across Australia. You can reach the Bongiorno National Network on +613 9863 3111.